it became clear to me that, you know, in a lot of developing countries in particular, fish is the main protein, one of the main livelihoods. And of course, you know, we've heard over the last two decades, nothing but kind of dire stories about overfishing and depletion of the resource. So I really was trying to figure out, where are the fish going to come from to feed a growing world? And as I got into it, I realized that a lot of the perceptions that people have about the state of fisheries are based on things that were happening in the 1990s.
Nicholas P. Sullivan is my guest on this episode of Inside Ideas, brought to you by 1.5 Media, Innovators Magazine, and sponsored by the Lojas Regenerative Foundation. Nicholas is a writer and editor focusing on the impact of business and technology on international development. The Blue Revolution, his fourth book, what we're here to talk about today. I'm sorry I don't have a physical copy to hold up. It's fresh and hot off the press. Just barely has been released by Island Press. It follows money real quick. Kenya's disruptive mobile money innovation. You can hear Nicholas speak about how microloans and cell phones are connecting the world's poor to the global economy and computer power for small business. He has been a co-director of the Fletcher School of Leadership Program for Financial Inclusions, Tufts by Tufts University, a consultant to central banks in developing countries, and a visiting scholar at MIT's Lakatum Center for International Development. In the publishing world, he was a publisher of Innovations, Technology, Governance, Globalization, MIT Press, editor-in-chief of Inc.com, and editor-in-chief of Home Office Computing. Nicholas is currently a senior fellow at the Fletcher School's Council on Emerging Market Enterprise and senior research fellow at its Maritime Studies Program. Nicholas has twice been a Rockefeller Foundation Bellagio Center resident fellow, a graduate of Harvard University, and the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. He lives in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Welcome to the podcast, Nicholas. It's so nice to have you. I'm sure I could go on and on your biography. You've been around the block and seen quite a bit.
Yeah, that's quite a mouthful. And thank you for that. And thank you for inviting me on your illustrious podcast. It's a treat.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad it worked out. There were some struggles originally with my traveling, and that we were able to coordinate it and really make it work. I deal a lot with food, with food systems and global things. And the thing that has always been lacking over the years is really that knowledge about what's going on in the seas, you know, and even in the environmental circles. We usually talk about airplanes and we talk about what's going on the land, but there's not a lot of discussion in depth that comes out what's happening on the seas and fisheries and the whole industry. And so I really loved your book. I didn't get a physical copy because I'm in Hamburg, Germany, but I read the digital copy twice, and I want you to know just a thank you. It's fabulous. It's right in the direction that I love to read about. One, and I'm going to get to the question soon, but because you are really taking kind of a new angle or twist than most other books around seafood or fisheries and what's going on, it's really about this almost the digital transformation, the data and the revolution and what new technologies and what innovations, and from your past of writing and things, there's a lot of innovation there as well. So it doesn't surprise me, but I'm a sustainable development goal advocate. And most people don't know six of the major things that we need to do, transformations, transitions, in order to achieve them in the Paris Agreement. are really key factors to get us there. And one of them is this digital transformation, this information age, and how we understand it and we use it properly. And that's really what the heart of your book addresses so much. So I want to start out slow and kind of get everybody up to speed and then get into more depth and substance as we go along in our conversation. What led you to address these and to dive into this type of a publication?
Well, I, as you noted in my bio, most of my recent work has been on international development in financial inclusion, starting with the spread of cell phones through South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, and then which morphed in for people who never had phones were now able to conduct business by phone. And then that morphed into mobile money. People who never had phones or bank accounts were sending money over their phones. And so that led to, consulting work with central banks and other groups trying to get more people into the banking system. And a lot of the work that I was doing, I was through USAID, Agency for International Development. And every place you would go, they would always have, they would be working on food security issues as well as finance and economic issues. So it became clear to me that, in a lot of developing countries, in particular, fish is the main protein, one of the main livelihoods. And of course, we've heard over the last two decades, nothing but kind of dire stories about overfishing and depletion of the resource. So I really was trying to figure out where are the fish going to come from to feed a growing world. And as I got into it, I realized that a lot of the perceptions that people have about the state of fisheries are based on things that were happening in the 1990s, the incredible overfishing and the depletion of some kind of iconic stocks like the Atlantic cod and the Norwegian salmon farming, which had all kinds of negative environmental effects. But in the last 20 years or so, there's been really a major shift, a behavioral shift, policy shift toward more sustainable, restorative, wild capture and farming techniques. So I was trying to tell that story. And of course, I had done, through Inc. magazine and, working on entrepreneurship, a lot of written about the impact of technology on society and business and individuals. And of course, I could see some of that stuff happening in fishing as well, that technology seeping into the industry a little bit later than some of the other industries, like, say car manufacturing has been kind of automated for quite a while, and service industries highly automated or, digitized. But fishing was always a throwback industry that is now really beginning to change. So that's kind of the origin of the story.
Love it. And I think it's really vital. So the full title of the book is The Blue Revolution, Hunting, Harvesting, and Farming Seafood in the Information Age. And so, a lot of people tend to judge books by the cover. So they're like, this is all about, these things, but it's really some of the things that are emerging and why they're emerging because of some illegal and crazy things going on in our oceans and our waterways that are pretty eye-opening. And you tell a few of those stories in the book. I just for full open transparency, I'm on the sustainable advisory board of a new kind of a blockchain-based company that has a big contract with one of Germany's largest seafood companies to try to get that traceability in there through distributed ledger technology, the blockchain, these smart contracts, where they actually do it from catch to the freezer is kind of their motto, is catch to the freezer. The company's called ours. And it's just very interesting to see how necessary that is and how vital some of these things are, this open and transparency, and to kind of see you know, is this sustainably harvested or sustainably caught seafood? Is it really what the package says it is, and things that, and those are some really important things. And so every chapter, there's 13 chapters in your book broken up into three parts. It's really kind of not only a nice journey, but these nice stories of different areas of what's going on. And I love the fact that you break it down into these stories. And one of the ones that really caught my eye was about some the illegal thing. I think you called them the Godfather.
Oh, the Codfather.
The Codfather.
Godfather in New Bedford, yes.
Yeah, the Codfather in New Bedford. And if you don't mind, I'd just love to hear in your own voice if you tell us a little bit about, you know, some of those illegal things and why that almost kind of pushes into why we need some new systems, some new models in the industry to kind of avoid that.
Well, yeah, the Codfather, his name is Carlos Rafael, who was a Portuguese immigrant, very successful fisher, owned more than 40 boats. And what he was doing, and eventually kind of entrapped by FBI undercover investigators, was, you know, misreporting his catch, mislabeling his catch, not accounting or for the money he was making, and all of which was illegal because you're supposed to obviously adhere to certain quotas for each stock and label the fish for what they are and report the landings and so forth. But he had not only his own boats, but his own processing facility. So he was able to go, he was able to kind of sidestep a lot of the oversight. And so he was, you know, trapped by these, you know, undercover investigators who, you know, the truth came out, and then he was, you know, tried and convicted, did 4 years in jail, and is now out. But so I use him as, he's a colorful figure, obviously, and but I use him as kind of a pivot point of the end of one era, or the old era, the old cowboy of the sea era in fishing, at least in New England, where I'm focusing the book, or in lots of, you know, lots of the parts of the world with this. And so he is giving way to a kind of a new breed, a new behavior, a new way of thinking about behavior and policy. And of course, you know, fishermen are not, you know, like anyone is going, they're going to get away with whatever they can get away with. But there are more and more, you know, constraints and oversight and regulations that are helping manage the fish. And of course, I say a couple of times that the last 20 years have been better for the fish than for the fishermen, because the new policies and regulations and catch quotas, which have been in the US at least, and many parts of Europe and Scandinavia and even South America, New Zealand, Australia, have been very well managed. It's resulted in a kind of consolidation of the industry. There are fewer boats, far fewer boats. The boats are more expensive. It's much harder for younger people to get into the business and so forth. So it's been pretty rough on fishermen, but it's been pretty good for the resource because a lot of stocks have been rebuilt. And in the US, 45 stocks that were overfished in 2000 have now been rebuilt. And there are others that are in the rebuilding phase, but so all that has been a positive. And, you know, it clearly is not happening everywhere in the world. And there's a lot of illegal fishing on the high seas. And, but even that is getting more, becoming more transparent with satellite data. And there's this group called Global Fishing Watch. I don't know if you know them, that shows satellite maps of all the boats on the sea and, you know, real time, basically. And you can tell who's fishing where and so forth. And that has led to a lot of apprehension and arrests of illegal fishermen on the high sea.
Yeah, so, that's it. It's a super project, and I love that. There's a couple sites like that as well, not just on fishing, but also on ship movement in general, just unidentified ships. You know, they sort them by colors, and they also container ships and how much is moved on the seas. It's really interesting to see. It's almost like, you know, this unbelievable map of who's got a license, who's unknown, who's really illegal, who's in areas of water that are off limits, and what are they doing there in real time? It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And the problem with policing the ocean is that it's, you know, 70% of the planet, and they're Interpol, the international, you know, police have, I don't know how many boats they have, but it's not that many. Sea Shepherd and some other NGO type organizations again. But I think, you know, you had mentioned earlier, we were talking about the regional kind of maritime organizations that are kind of bonding to, there's a couple on both, I think one on the East Coast and West Coast of Africa. There's one, I think, in the East Coast of South America. Brazil, Uruguay, and Argentina have bonded together. There's one in the Western Pacific of, you know, small nations that are really kind of bonding together to police their own ocean.
I love that fact that we do have that policing, but it would be nice if we could get some technology and systems in place that fishermen and industrial scale fisheries or fish mongering and all of that, the catch industry would use different practices. And so it's really in the same chapter, the chapter we're talking about is chapter 3, the cowboys on the high sea almost, you know, is it possible to fish at an industrial scale in a post-industrial mode? You know, I know there's Blue Harvest fisheries out there and some other post-industrial fleets, but is it possible?
Well, I think one of the things that makes it, you know, I do say that it's shifting from industrial to post-industrial. And what I mean by industrial is that basically there's no regard for anything except maximizing the catch, maximizing the profit, and so forth. So there's no regard for any external negative impact on, you know, the resource or the habitat. So yeah, it is possible. I mean, one way is just to avoid, unwanted bycatch. If you're just trawling, you know, randomly and pulling up everything, a lot of the fish you're not going to want, it's not going to be high value. It's going to get tossed overboard. And so that has basically been stopped in the last 20 years. with, you know, not totally stopped, but so I think that makes a big difference, because you're not just catching everything in your net and keeping only the value stuff. You're targeting the valued species that you're after. And, you know, working within limits and, reporting the catch to the regulators when you're still at sea before you land. And then there are, you know, people on the docks, you know, environmental police, fishing regulators, you know, checking the catch and the load to see if it conforms to the stated catch that you phoned in. So I do think it's possible, and there are better freezing and chilling systems on boats now, which is obviously an expensive investment, but it means that the catch is better handled and arrives on shore in better shape, and so again, it's kind of respecting the resource and increasing the value of the catch.
I have a bunch of questions, so I'm glad you brought up bycatch, and I want to go a little bit more into that. And matter of fact, I was just looking here because I have a bycatch device that is I want to show you that it's really fabulous. Shoot, I don't have it right in front of me, but it's a device that. It was based on lighting. There was an old 1913 paper written by a professor who did some research that all fish types, species, see a different light spectrum. They're attracted or detracted to a different light spectrum. And that was an old paper that some new innovators and some new people who were trying to solve some challenges around our oceans read and said, how could we use this to reduce bycatch? And they came up with this lighting system that is integrated in the nets that have lights for escape holes for certain size of fish that they don't want to catch, and that it doesn't attract those that they do want to keep in the net. And just this cool lighting system, and it's really a great thing that's reduced bycatch down to 1%, so of unwanted product. Because I assume so the industrial agriculture on land, the monoculture is not working for us anymore. But how does the bycatch, where we're just grabbing anything that gets into the net, and then I know in Europe, there are some laws and regulations that whatever they catch, they can't throw the rest back overboard, that they have to somehow keep it or use it, that release. There's some laws and regulations about that. What is that like in the U.S. and how complicated is that entire system, not only with what they're doing with the nets, but how can they really control all that bycatch that they get in there? And is bycatch another word for waste, food waste, or how does that work? Can you explain that?
Well, yeah, it has been it has been wasted food, really, because it's typically been thrown overboard, and you know, some of them survive, but most of them, I think, don't. And but you know, to your point about the lights, I was unaware of that, but there's certainly all kinds of new nets that are designed to let certain species escape the trawl net, you know, and certain fish swim up when they hit a net and other fish swim down. Certain fish fit through certain ring size. So they are making adjustments in the gear to allow fish to escape. There's been experiments with, you know, you talk about the lights underwater, but the cameras underwater that are sending images up to the pilot's computer with machine learning, so you can tell, you know, what kind of fish are going into the net, what size, what species, and so forth. And so it gives you more kind of a sense of what's going on underneath the ocean, underneath the surface of the water, and allows you to adjust on the fly. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is, you know, being newly introduced, and obviously, you know, it's an expense to change gear, to add gear, to, you know, design new gear, but it's, you know, it's all part of the kind of more of a post-industrial mode where we're not gonna just suck everything up. And of course, you know, in the high seas, there are all these UN regulations against drift nets that capture everything, from turtles, sharks, puffin, and, you know, albatross, everything. And it's awful. Or long lines that go for miles and miles and miles that hook everything. And that's a different story than the, you know, fishing on the continental shelf. So the continental shelf is where most fish are found. But of course, some of the high value fish, the tuna, the sharks, or the migratory species that are out in the high seas. And so stopping the bycatch on the high seas is a little still kind of a wild west with the long lines and the drift nets and so forth.
I appreciate you going in, and sorry, I didn't mean to be rude, but I usually have that device right next to me, and I wanted to show it to you because it was actually, I worked with a foundation for a long time that invested in innovations for purpose that solve some form of a global grand challenge. And one of them was this bycatch, and I actually have a working model that they gave me because we would talk about it a lot. And so I wanted to show it to you. I wrote a book as well. It's called The Beauty of Impact Health. And they were in that book as well. There are a lot more than, you know, in the last 10, 15 years that have really emerged on the scene to help to reduce bycatch, because it's the waste of the sea. And, you know, even if they're throwing it back in the oceans or whatever the regulations are, in the spots where they're fishing, most of that bycatch that's then thrown back is dead anyway, and it's just a horrible thing for the ecosystem of our oceans, and creates a huge number of problems. But there are some other methods. If they do get it on board, how do they report it properly? How do they label it and divide it so that nothing's wasted, so that it's kept in and sold off to eat or used in some way if we are going to kill these animals or these fish. So I mean, that for me is really, really a big aspect of it. There is another thing that, you know, in that same discussion is, not only is there various monitoring systems to monitor the catch quotas and effectiveness, but there's also, you know, sometimes the difference between what's caught on the open sea and what's then reported or unloaded at the docks, and how does that happen? It's just another illegal portion of what's going on. Is that how I understand it? Because there's not enough traceability.
Well, you know, one thing they're starting to use now is electronic monitoring, so that you have electronic monitors on the boats, so you can, rather than having human observers on the boats, you can see from the shore what is really being caught. I think, you know, it depends where you, what part of the world you're in, you know, and a lot of the stuff that I think you're talking about is from the, you know, illegal unreported fishing, and, you know, where that fish has landed is unknown. I think ports in Asia, maybe in China, and there's probably less restrictions there than there are in some other more developed fishing nations. So it really, I think, it's kind of a tale of two cities, really, and, you know, and how fish are handled and treated. But I think, you know, the basic trend is positive. And it's also true for the farmed fish. You know, I mean, there used to be this kind of saying that friends don't let friends eat farm fish because it's bad. But I heard someone from the Nature Conservancy, head of aquaculture, the other day, which is focusing on, you know, shellfish and kelp, which is quite restorative to waters, doesn't use food and so forth. And he said that 70% of the marine aquaculture or mariculture now is shellfish and kelp, which is, you know, very healthy for the oceans. So, and as far as the nearshore farming that was going on in Norway in the 90s, that has kind of shifted into either land-based farming of finfish or offshore farming in colder, deeper waters with swifter currents, so there's less of the, you know, degradation of the seafloor, of buildup of sea lice, and all those issues that were prevalent in the 90s. And of course, the other big issue that environmentalists and biologists rightly complained about in the early days of, you know, industrial aquaculture was the use of forage fish, like, you know, herring, menhaden, shad, capelin, and so forth, to for fish meal and fish oil to feed farm fish. So people are saying, why are you robbing the ocean of these forage fish that, you know, wild fish eat to you know, feed farm fish? And of course now, you know, so the ratio of wild of feed to farm fish used to be like 5 to 1. It's now more 1 to 1, and there are other, you know, alternatives. There are soy alternatives, there are single cell protein alternatives. So there's less and less of the forage fish being used for that. So that's another kind of major shift in, you know, global farming practices.
I mean, how would you, there's, and I want to talk about more on this chapter as well, but there is this, you know, big green revolution, but how does that compare to the blue revolution, you know? There's also this controversy between the actual farmers or in the oceans and the science behind it, what the scientists are saying. And how do those two worlds, are they merging together? How are they playing together? And what do you see emerging?
Well, I think, again, it depends where you are in the world. I mean, in, you know, places like China, they've been farming for centuries, and still that by far, I think that 60% of the world's aquaculture is from China. And most of it actually is freshwater, not saltwater. And I have to look just at saltwater. So the, you know, the green revolution, you know, in the 60s and 70s started in Mexico and then India and parts of Asia, was, you know, just increased wheat and rice yields by 2 or 3 times through irrigation and fertilizers and so forth. But eventually they kept, you know, ended up degrading the soil despite the increase, because they planted the same crops in the same places year after year after year. And then the blue revolution, which started in India in the 80s and in other parts of Asia, was an aquaculture revolution. And again, the idea there was just to increase production, keep increasing the yield. And it too made some of the same mistakes as the green revolution in terms of, you know, ripping out mangrove swamps to farm shrimp, and overcrowding, you know, freshwater ponds and lakes. Excuse me. So I use the term blue revolution a little more broadly. So it started as an aquaculture thing in Asia, but I say it's kind of shifted to the West and other parts of the world, and it's including both the wild capture and the farmed fish, because some of the technologies, some of the, you know, behavioral shifts are similar. So anyway, what the Nature Conservancy would say about the Blue Revolution is that, and they of course refer to it as a farming term as well, is that farming should be either nearshore shellfish and kelp, offshore finfish, or land-based, you know, water tanks. All the new finfish farms in the US now basically are these land-based recirculating aquaculture systems, which are basically huge tanks of water that is kind of 95% of which is purified and recirculated. And so the jury is still a little bit out on the economics of those systems, but it does remove a lot of the issues of the environmental issues from the ocean, and, you know, in a much more controlled environment on land. But they're very high tech kind of wastewater systems or life support systems, highly automated with machine learning and sensors and automatic feeding. And so there's probably more, you know, technology going into the farming than there is into the wild capture at the moment. And you mentioned the scientists, and I think that, you know, by and large, the people doing the farming, it's very different. They're very different people than the fishermen, who are hunters, basically. And the farmers are more likely to be entrepreneurs or scientists, and and younger, and many more women. I mean, obviously in the wild capture hunting, there are very few women, except in, you know, artisanal Pacific African fisheries, you know, near shore, a lot of women. But so they're, again, two very different stories, the wild capture and the farmed.
What do you really see emerging? Do you see a local blended mix, or is it really all those things need to occur at the same time? I mean, what are you seeing? Because we tend to get in this silo, so we find something that works, we extract it until it's dead or gone, and then we move to the next silo. Do you see that shifting kind of more into ecosystems, or into the way we change not only how we farm, but also how we eat, which influences that as well?
Yeah, well, I do think that, you know, I mentioned earlier that the old saying was that friends don't let friends eat farmed fish. I think now, you know, and increasingly fish are seen as fish, whether they're farmed or wild. And obviously some people still have their biases and their emotional reaction to either or both. But the big shift is getting coastal communities to accept both, because in coastal communities that are fishing, you know, communities, it's very hard to accept the idea of farmed fish coming in, even if it's not competing directly with the fish that they're catching. But it's like, it's seen as undercutting their territory. So I think that there's certainly a lot of that going on in Maine now, in the U.S., which has got, you know, a long history of, you know, lobster and clamming and ground fishing, and now the farms are coming in, and so there's a battle for the, you know, spatial planning on the water. There's a battle for the water. There's a battle on land, because, you know, people don't want it in their backyards. So, but it's being worked out. And I think that it's basically, I think, a good thing, because for coastal communities, I mean, it's an economic revitalization to have, you know, a new form of science-based, technology-based farming come into, you know, communities, many of which have lost a lot of fishing boats over the last two decades. So, you know, it would be interesting to see how this plays out over the next couple of decades. But, and the other thing about the farming, it doesn't even have to be on the coast. With the recirculating aquaculture systems, there's a big salmon farm in Wisconsin, one in Indiana. They can be anywhere. There's fresh, you know, freshwater, you know,
aquaculture. Source. Yeah, sources. Yeah, so, I'm saying a lot of that as well. And you talk in the book as well about RAS and some other onshore fish farms, basically. I want to stick with the ecosystem a little bit for just one more second. So in chapter four, you talk about eating with the ecosystem, you know, that there are abundant and sustainable species. I've been learning more and more, or hearing more and more. I don't know if I'm learning. I haven't really seen all the numbers and been able to be, but that some people say the only sustainable fish to eat is a carp, you know, and things like that. And I've heard absolutely crazy things. And so it's sometimes really hard to believe. And you've even had some models, you know, assume that it's illegal or it's bad, and then prove it wrong that it is in the end. How are we taking these local catch CSFs and also both the fishermen into this sustainable fish movement? And does it really exist? Is it not just specific spots of the world, but is it emerging all over as well?
Well, the you know, it definitely lags behind the foodie locavora movement and the community supported agriculture, but it is growing really fast. I think now in the US there are 500 or more local catch, just, you know, drop points. And you know, as you say, that there is more and more emphasis on and demand for fish that is local and fresh, even if that fish is flash frozen and shipped, it was still considered kind of local and fresh. that is not kind of your iconic cod, shrimp, or salmon, but you know, redfish or pollock or hake or fluke or monkfish or skate. There are all these other species that are very plentiful now because they've not been sought after by, they haven't been high value fish. But of course their value is increasing now as some of the other fish are declining. And there's certainly a lot of, you know, effort. You know, most fish in many, probably in Europe and the US, not so much in Africa and Asia, but most fish is eaten in restaurants and not cooked at home. Now there's a big movement to teach people how to cook these unknown, unloved species. And so that movement is definitely, definitely growing. And there's more, you know, producers, fishermen, selling direct to consumers. And of course, not everyone is going to want to do that because it's like a different business almost. Requires, you know, setting up a new system. But that's also another very positive thing because, you know, it connects people to the product and to the person catching or producing that product, as opposed to just this global commodity that has traveled the world, you know, 5-10,000 miles. I mean, there's some fish that is, you know, caught in the US, frozen, shipped overseas for processing, refrozen, shipped back, ends up in the supermarket. And, you know, it's probably not the best tasting piece of fish you can find. So I think that's part of the reason. I mean, you talk about the traceability that you're involved with. And if people knew that was where their fish was coming from, if they could see that traceability blockchain on the packaging, they would they would think twice. They would go down to their local, or they'd order, even if they lived, you know, that 1,000 miles from the ocean, they'd order frozen fish, which is one interesting thing that you really can't do with vegetables, right? You can't really freeze and ship vegetables. You've got to be on the spot. But the the fish, you know, Alaska is shipping fish all over the world now, and it's, you know.
Yeah, they are. I remember 20 years ago, you know, it'd be really exclusive. People would take trips up to Alaska to go fishing and bring stuff back and ship it back. It's really become a crazy thing. Now you don't even need to go up there to do it anymore. You just order it online. They ship it down. And it's just, you know, a big other thing that we deal with in our food systems is we're shipping things exorbitant miles across the world. And it's just not the best method. The other thing is we're shipping stuff that's local elsewhere, thousands of miles, just to be processed or refrozen or you know, and then to just be shipped right back. And in regular agriculture, you know, we have commodity crops and things that you know, they'll sell this many potatoes to Russia, and then that many potatoes they'll buy from somewhere else to bring in. And it's just not this local food web anymore. And it's really not, I wouldn't say a scandalous, but if you cheapen food and you start adding tons of miles on it, it's just, you're cheapening life. So I really, you know, in this eating like your ecosystem, like the fish would eat, that I think is a pretty good model. Have you seen really positive things come out of that? I mean, throughout your book, I think there's at least four or more different just examples of how it's positive.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it, you know, really changed during the pandemic too, I think, because, you know, fishermen did not have, you know, restaurants were closed, and that's was kind of where their product went. And there was a lot of really kind of interesting and encouraging experimentation going on with selling direct, selling right on the docks, people coming down to buy right off the boat, or you know, freezing and shipping, selling through local farmers markets, which is, you know, mostly vegetables and other things, but fish going into the farmers markets. So, and often, you know, unusual fish, not, you know, so I don't know, you know, Americans are so, most of what they eat is farmed shrimp and salmon from around the world and tuna from around the world. So that's going to change somehow.
Absolutely. Yeah. I live in Hamburg, Germany, which is a harbor town. And so there's a lot of, you know, fresh fish markets. So every morning, you know, real early, I think it starts something like 4:35 in the morning. Mm. There's the fish markets open every day, and people usually, especially on the weekends, they go party and then just party through and then get a, you know, just go right down to the docks, to the fish market and buy, you know, freshly caught fish. But there's a lot of fish markets around here where you can pick out your fish. Is that always the freshest when you're going to these fish, what do they call this? A fish market, I guess is what you call it. Is that the best way to do it?
To go to a local fish market?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, again, it depends on how long the fish has been, how long ago the fish was caught, and how well it was handled. I mean, that's the other thing that is really, I think, changing a bit is people are experimenting with ways to improve the handling of the fish so that it maintains, you know, its firmness and its taste for longer, and that it becomes a higher value product that you can charge more for. So that's the other kind of movement that is, you know, in the post-industrial sphere, is to increase the value rather than the volume. Increasing the value of the product, you know, lessens the fishing pressure because you don't have to catch as many fish. And it increases the value to the consumer. And of course, that connection is very important. And I mean, it improves the connection and actually sometimes creates the connection, because people say, this is really, you know, high value. And certain places now they're using this technique called ikajime, the Japanese technique of spinal, you know, tapping to kill quickly so that there's no fight in the fish. And it creates a much, you know, better tasting, longer lasting fish. And Iceland is doing something very interesting that is spreading around the world, or beginning to, is this 100% utilization of fish, because, you know, we talked about the waste from bycatch, but there's also waste from a, you know, a prize fish, even a codfish. 40% of it is just, you know, innards and bones and head and stuff that is often just thrown away. And Iceland is doing an incredible job of developing businesses to use all parts of the fish. And again, that's increasing the value to the fishermen, which reduces the pressure, the fishing pressure on the catch.
Is that part of the Iceland Ocean Cluster that you talk about in the book?
Started by Thor Sigfusson at Iceland Ocean Cluster. There's now in New England alone, there's three ocean clusters that are spinoffs of the Iceland one. And
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, there was a new bill just introduced in Congress a couple of weeks ago, requiring the Department of Commerce to develop ocean clusters in every region of the country. So I don't know if that bill will pass, but it's clearly an idea that is gaining currency.
Yeah, it's also it's kind of this localization idea. Is the fish available? Is it fresh? It's these local, it's almost like local economies around fish and fishing, which I really like. About 20 years ago, I used to live in, or maybe even more than 20 years ago, in Beverly, Massachusetts, the same thing. Mm. Get a lot of lobster and fresh fish there. And one thing my family used to like is these salmon burgers, and they were, you know, they were mixed of obviously salmon Atlantic salmon, I guess, I don't know, some kind of salmon, and but they only had them a certain amount of times, and you really had to go down, and it was, you just knew, okay, well, if I get there soon enough, or if I call on the phone and say, save me some, you're going to have them. But it wasn't always available. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't thing that you could just say, nope, I'm always going to have it available. And you also back then paid a premium for it. And I like these ocean clusters, and that you say, okay, well, no, it's not always going to be available. And it depends on where you live and where you're at in the world. And I think that will also allow the time for the industry and our oceans to kind of regenerate and recoup and kind of restore some of these where we're having bycatch problem or overfishing, and where it's creating a lot of problems around the world. So I love that. So there are U.S. clusters, ocean clusters, kind of emerging. What you're saying, but there's another kind of thing that you go into in chapter one, where you talk about this cod survey technique, and which has also been derived from the scallop survey technique. And so it's such a complex system with specific on the type of seafood or shellfish that you're talking about, on what the tools that are emerging that you use. You almost have to be a scientist to understand it all. Mm-hmm. And I guess you specifically spoke about Kevin Stokesby. So how is that technology or the technique emerging? And you also talked about the Japanese way of killing and handling fish. How do we find out about these besides reading your book? How does just the regular consumer know where the sustainable fisheries and sources and clusters are?
A lot of people have relied on the Monterey Bay Aquarium. They've got a little, I think I've got one in my wallet, a little cheat sheet on which fish are sustainable. So, what you're talking about, the Kevin Stokesbury, who's a scientist at UMass School for Marine Science and Technology, started out in the late 90s when the scallop grounds were basically closed. Dragging underwater cameras at the bottom of the seafloor to take pictures and to show the clusters of scallops developing. And it allowed the regulators to say, okay, and he worked with NOAA and the regulators on this, and they had different survey techniques, but it allowed them to open up the beds and to see, you know, where the scallops were of, you know, mature adult size and could be taken versus the small, or where they were proliferating or not. And but it's obviously easier with scallops, which don't really move. You just drag a camera on the bottom, you can see them, and it's much more difficult with finfish that are swimming. So what he's done there is a similar technique, but he's got a trawl net that is open-ended on both ends. So you're not capturing the fish. The fish are swimming through the net, and there are cameras in the net that record the fish going through. And this is what I was referring to earlier. Then there's a machine learning algorithm that, you know, identifies the species and the size and so forth. And so it's another way of surveying the stock without doing the deep water trawl or without dragging up the fish. And the hope there is, and there are now, you know, say 350 boats in New Bedford Harbor, and a lot of them have got sensors on them to detect, you know, the salinity, the oxygen level, the acidity of the ocean, and connect that to where they're finding the fish. And so the combination of that and the camera technique I just described, you know, eventually they're hoping that it just would be a way for people to, as they're fishing, to see what is coming into the net, connect it to the ocean, you know, characteristics of that spot, which will help them target, you know, the fish they're looking for, rather than just fishing randomly and filling their nets with. So that will help the bycatch, that will put the target on the right species, and will also give people better, it'll be a more efficient way to fish. The fishermen will have more data, you know.
So that really gets us into a couple other things. So where we're moving to, or what has emerged, farmed fish, sailfish, sea greens, aquaculture is really one of the fastest growing forms of food production in the world right now. And it's just, everybody's got it on their tongue and really talking about it. Also, Atlantic salmon farming is big in this RAS that we've kind of tickled upon. And that, can you help us understand that? I mean, people hear about it. We hear, you know, that they're doing it. I've been involved in some of them as well, but most people are just kind of, they don't know about it. They don't know that there's these other types. And is it controversial as we hear?
Well, the RAS is not, I don't think it's that controversial. There have been some communities that don't want, you know, plants built in their neighborhoods, but that's a different, people don't like change in their neighborhoods, no matter what it is. It's not as controversial as the original salmon farming in Norway, which had all kinds of problems. The RAS actually solves a lot of the problems. It takes it out of the ocean. There's no chance of escapement. You know, there was always that fear that farm fish would escape and then breed or introgress with wild fish and reduce their survival skills. And so it solves all those problems. And I think the real issue is just the economics of it. A lot can go wrong with these systems, right? They're huge life support systems. And, you know, the salmon take 2 or 3 years to grow out. You got to keep them alive for a long time. And you've got, you know, you start them in freshwater, which salmon spawn in, and then they go into saltwater. So you've got two different systems there. So it's really the economics for the, you know, for the operator. I can't, you know, it's uses a lot of electricity, a lot of water. And if something goes wrong, you can lose a lot of fish fast. So I think those are the issues.
I love that you bring that up. So I do a lot with vertical farming, or what we call controlled environmental agriculture. It's very similar. I also do a lot with cellular agriculture, which is kind of lab grown, lab based meats. So I love the concept of RAS, recirculating fish and having these fisheries that in theory are kind of a controlled environment of growing fish. The things that you just said are spot on. High energy costs, high operation costs, because the system has to be pretty robust. It has a freshwater tank, a saltwater tank. How do you feed them? Then there's also different in controlled environment or agriculture, they have pathogens that come in. They could have pests that come in. They could have mold come in the system. Well, the same thing can happen with a RAS system as well. The thing that I really like that I'm not seeing emerging in these new innovations and technologies like RAS or like controlled environmental agriculture or vertical farming is that no one is really doing it 100% the right way, which I mean, I believe strongly if we use renewable energy, we use battery backups, we harvest our own rainwater or and ambient water for the fresh water, we get some salt water and do the things in a controlled environment, whether it's RAS or vertical farming or controlled environment or agriculture, to keep the pathogens out, to maintain that they're not overcrowded, that they're not getting these things that occur. It's actually a better business model because you don't have that high overhead. You're not paying high prices for your water, for your energy, for your storage, because it's a closed system and it's generating that, which reduces your costs of goods sold so that you can be competitive at market. I know a lot of RAS operations that are charging a pretty premium price for their products because of that high setup, that high initial cost. And there's a sweet spot of scale on some of these operations and a high turnout requirement so that they can recoup that initial setup process. But if they chose a different model, I think it would be a different system. And so I love that you bring that up, but have you seen any transitions in this area where, with those who say, hey, you know, it's a resilient way to do it on land, to not mess with our oceans. But there are some better models of doing it more effectively.
Well, I mean, they're all talking about, using solar panels and biofuels to run their plants because they realize the electricity is a huge, huge issue. The other thing that's really encouraging, I think, is, the beginning of hydroponics, using some of the fish water then to go into the greenhouses to grow vegetables, which is they're doing in Wisconsin. Huge, leafy green greenhouses with...
Yeah, they call that aquaponics and, systems. I love that.
Hydroponics, yeah. The
aquaponics.
Aquaponics, right. Yes, yeah, correct. And there's one in... there's a steelhead farm in New York State that is growing hemp that way, which is a higher value crop than a leafy green vegetable. And that also, improves the economics of the systems. And, from a food perspective, it's great because, in fact, the guy in John Eng in Hudson Valley Farms in New York State says that, what he's doing, he could do anywhere. He could basically do it in a desert, because you only need a certain amount of water, and once you've got that, you can just keep reusing it, and you can grow all kinds of stuff. You can grow the fish and all kinds of other vegetables or hemp or anything. And so that's kind of a brave new world, a brave new idea. I mean, I think Israel is probably doing things like that in their deserts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This, you have a chapter that's after one of the old books of that's close to my heart, Fish for a Small Planet.
Oh, yes.
Francis Moore Lapis, she's also been on the podcast. She wrote the book Diet for a Small Planet. And I think it's so true. Fish for a small planet. How do we do it different? How do we use RAS? How do we use other opportunities that are more regenerative, more sustainable?
Use that title for that chapter is because Josh Goldman, who started the first RAS in the US to grow Barramundi in the early 90s, was had read Diet for a Small Planet in high school. So he had that kind of mindset. And then he was working with this group called, or he was influenced by this group called BioShelters, which again is kind of like the holistic closed system that you're talking about. But he was doing it as a college student. He was doing it in this greenhouse. He was growing tilapia, I think, to begin with. And then he, anyway, he ended up, he's in Vietnam now. He's kind of gone from the RAS, which is still in operation in Massachusetts, to doing barramundi in the ocean off Vietnam. So he's had quite a interesting aquaculture career.
And would you call that more of like a movement into a more regenerative or permaculture type of practice, but on the seas? I mean, where he's now doing it in a different way, or is it just like a form of farm fishing in the seas or off the coast where they quarantine off these areas?
Yeah, well, he does the spawning on land in tanks and, you know, getting the fish up to a certain size or age, then puts them in net pens in the ocean. And I think, you know, the high cost that we were just talking about, it's one of the issues. And one of the reasons he made the switch is because you obviously in the ocean, you don't have those high costs of electricity. You have other issues. You have to be able to monitor it and get to it and so forth. But so I think part of it was just the business model. He felt to scale the way he wanted to scale, it would be more efficient to farm in the ocean rather than on land.
Absolutely. I mean,
you can ask him about that, but I think that was his rationale.
I love that. Yeah. It made me kind of think about another kind of not innovation, but another great organization, the Crab Bank in Thailand. Have you heard about any of those? They have these great crab banks in Thailand. They were losing all their crabs and blue crabs, and it was just bad. And it was also affecting tiger sharks and kind of having a ripple effect in their local fishing areas and their biodiversity, which is kind of like a real intricate web. What they would do is, whenever the fishermen and the crab catchers would go out and catch a crab that had obviously was very visible that they had a bunch of eggs, they would bring them to the crab bank, and they had all these paint buckets that with bubbling water, and they would keep them in there until they're ready to hatch. And then as they're ready to hatch, they kind of go out to a protected area and they re-release, you know, billions of eggs at a time. And it's really brought back the entire ecosystem of that area in Thailand. It's off of, I think it's Chantaburi is the name of the place. Chantaburi in Thailand is the location, but it's a fabulous project. And it's really just done a lot for the locals, for the whole community to have projects like that. So I really love that. Now we you touch upon it a little bit, but not quite a bit. A lot of our problems are created now with plastics, pure ocean water, phytoplankton being an issue, but also how much algaes and kelp and mussels and oysters can really clean up our, not only our air and our oceans and do a lot of good and create other products, that's all kind of emerging out. And you talk about scallops and all sorts of scallops, mussels, oysters, clams, and other things. That's a whole nother web that's opening up. And so I want to go into that, but I kind of want to caveat it first with a question. You did a lot for MIT, and MIT back in 1972 came out with the books, The Limits to Growth. And Donella Meadows, Dennis Meadows, who lives kind of close to Hampton, New Hampshire, is close to Boston, Massachusetts. And your granders and Steve Behrens, who worked at MIT on the World Model 3, which is a systems model thing and the systems thinking concept and the webs, and later created a lot of dynamic models on fisheries, on seafood webs, and how the inputs, the stock takes in those. Was any of that, since you did some work at MIT or any of that, was that kind of an influence for you to see this bigger web of what's going on in your work and that?
Well, no, not really. but I did start thinking about, you know, fishing in general as a very complex system itself, you know, much more complex than the average person thinks it is, because they just react to overfishing or bad or, but it's a very complex system. And once you begin to tweak one part of it, you inevitably affect other parts of it. So the MIT work, I've heard of that. I've never studied that or read that, but I did start to think of fishing, both farmed and wild, as very complex systems that it's very easy to have, you know, unintended consequences. And, you know, one being, you know, I mentioned earlier, just the consolidation, you know, the regulations and the quotas that have been good for the fish in terms of protecting the resource have been bad for the fishermen. And because it's, they're losing boats, they don't get quota, they can't afford the permits. And so that's an example of, you know, making a change to a system that affects, you know, the people in the system. So the shellfish and the kelp that you mentioned, as you know, I mentioned the Nature Conservancy said that 70% of the marine or the mariculture is bivalves and kelp, and it's very restorative. You know, it cleans up near shore waters, excess nitrogen, and kelp is a buffer against CO2. It absorbs CO2. And there've been in you know, Maine mussel farmers will tell you that growing kelp and mussels together or in close proximity, the mussel shells are much stronger and grow faster because they're not getting the acidity is being absorbed by the kelp. And it means the meats grow plumper and faster because the acidity is a major concern on shell building, and more so with mussels than oysters even. It's a thinner shell. You mentioned phytoplankton, and you know, there are worries that the phytoplankton, you know, they're small microorganism, like vegetable matter at the bottom of the seafood chain, of the food chain in the ocean. You know, the phytoplankton are eaten by the zooplankton, are eaten by the little forage fish, are eaten by the bigger fish. But the phytoplankton are declining in numbers, and they have less energy than they used to. And by energy, meaning energy from the sun, because they use photosynthesis, they absorb carbon dioxide, and they have chlorophyll, they emit oxygen. More than 50% of the world's oxygen comes from these little minuscule organisms. And so there's a worry that with climate change, there's less upwelling of nutrients from the bottom of the ocean to feed the phytoplankton. There's less energy then being transferred into the forage fish, less energy transferred into the larger fish. So the whole climate change thing is, you know, is another issue that we talk about as one of the global challenges, which is kind of confounding. I mean, it's a challenge for all walks of life and regions, but obviously a big impact on the oceans too. The warmer water holds less oxygen and makes it harder for large fish in particular to swim. And at a time when they need to exert more energy to get their food, because there's less energy in the foods. So it's a kind of a confounding cycle.
I spoke to you about my book, Menu B, and asked for your advice. And thank you, by the way, on some things around fishing, some other authors and experts. The one big aspect is our global food systems has this complexity and the systems in it. But more and more, it's this big web of life that's always interconnected to many other parts of the world, many other parts of the ocean and land as well. And even there's even so much land and dust storms and tropical storms over the Amazon that really also through diatoms feed those phytoplankton, feed the oceans, create the blue algaes, create these blooms in the oceans that really you see this big cycle of life moving around that's not just only in the blue part of our world, but also in the sand part of our world that seeds clouds, causing them to rain and then drop that food and nutrients back into the oceans and into the water to feed phytoplankton and to create diatoms, to create algae blooms, to create the feeding frenzy for fish or to create food for fish. And we sometimes don't see that big connection of these complex web systems, but how much we're affecting that through the in this Anthropocene that we're in by human actions, the way we treat the world. You know, some recent studies, matter of fact, it was just yesterday, I heard that, you know, every day or every week, we're eating about a credit card worth of plastic every week, just in the food that we eat, and that they found plastic in human blood now and things like that. And we definitely know it's in our oceans and degrading, turning into microplastic, and that the seafood can't distinguish it from phytoplankton, from microplankton, or plastic. And so somehow it's getting into our food system in that big chain of life.
That is something that, you know, I didn't address that in the book. I thought about it a couple of times, but I was having enough trouble keeping up with everything else. But I know for some people, they won't eat fish because they say there's microplastics out there and I don't want to eat it. Yeah, and there was a lot of talk about it at the North American Seafood Expo that I went to last month. And yeah, it's clearly a huge issue. And again, it's kind of like climate change. I mean, how, you know, what has been done is going to take 50 years. Even if everything stopped today, it would be another 50 years, probably at least, of dealing with the kind of downstream effects. So,
yeah, absolutely. And it's not just, I mean, don't ever want to blame it all on the fish or that, because it's also the animal agriculture. And a lot of our grains and feedstock, believe it or not, they're taking old food waste, bread packages, and many other things with the plastic still on it. And they're just grinding it up and putting it into animal feed. And those animals are eating that. And so there's just bad practices out there that aren't sustainable. They're not regenerative. They're bad farming practices. They're driven by low cost of high industrial production of food or fishing, wherever it is. And I love what your book brings out is this really this shift. And let's get it digitized. Let's get it into the information age. Let's have some accountability, some measurability, some transparency where we can see what's happening. And let's let the not put the onus on the consumer, but let's have them make the choice of what they want to eat, where they want to get it, which should push more value and more local accountability and profitability to those industries in that market. They say, no, our consumers will pay more for a better product, one that's not full of bad practices, and kind of do that reformation or change the way we do it. Because in the end effect, it's really about the long-term sustainability or regeneration of those supply chains of those products. If we keep doing this extractive and let's just overfish and bycatch and deplete until nothing's left, then nothing's left. So we've got to figure out how can we work in that ecosystem to make sure it's around for future generations of humanity in a good way. Because fish is, when it's done right and when it's not full of plastics or bad things, then it's a beautiful thing to have, you know? Mm. So, and I love the fact that you also mentioned, let's teach people how to cook and do these other species that they've probably never heard of before, because they're used to fish sticks and cod or certain types of salmon or trout, but they've never tried Victoria barsh or rote barsh or, you know, many, many other fabulous types of fish. And
yeah, food. No, I think you're exactly right that the, you know, the consumer, it's so easy to put the blame on the producers all the time. And producers obviously don't do everything right, but the consumer has a big role to play in this as well, right? It's the other side of the equation, and it's the demand that drives the production. And if the demand is for a different product, it will force a different type of production. And so then it, I guess, is a question of education and information and, you know, getting the word out and so forth. But yeah, we've seen it happen in the land-based agriculture. So hopefully it will happen and is happening in the ocean-based aquaculture as well.
So you also, one of your chapters, the Holy Grail of farming the open seas, you talk about, you know, what the United States is doing, what kind of equipment and sensors, what kind of regulations are there, what federal agencies are in charge of farming in federal waters. That's complex in itself, but there's this thing you talk about, the seafood print metric. How does that compare to the carbon footprint metric that we've kind of heard a lot about? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that is from Daniel Pauly and the Sea Around Us at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And Daniel Pauly is, you know, one of the world's leading, most esteemed marine biologists, who always has interesting ways of looking at the world and framing the issues. And so he says that basically the seafood print is a way of measuring the amount of fish that if you eat a pound of, the way he puts it is a pound of tilapia is very different than a pound of tuna, because a pound of tuna has, at the top of the food chain, the tuna has eaten so many other, you know, types of fish have gone into that pound of tuna, whereas the tilapia is like a herbivore, basically at the very close to the bottom of the food chain. So, and he's, you know, he says that Americans really are, I don't know if they're leading the world, but they're close to the top of the world in the seafood print, because we like the high, the fish that are high in the food chain, you know, the tuna and the salmon, you know, the real carnivores. And
yeah,
so it's an interesting way of looking at it.
I agree.
And I mean, his point, because he's very always very cognizant of the impact in other parts of the world and artisanal fisheries and fisher people, you know, and that if the rich countries are sucking all this huge, you know, amount of seafood with every bite, it's just taking away from other, you know, people in other parts of the world. And so he's a very innovative thinker in that regard.
The last kind of book, you know, and some respects could be a little bit depressing. Question that I have for you is really, how does the level of marine extinctions compare to our terrestrial extinctions? To put that into perspective for our audience, since we usually don't see what's underwater. So,
right. Well, there have been no marine extinctions in the last 50 years, scientists say, although they also say that a lot of the data is deficient because there's a lot going on in the ocean that we don't know about. And the way they phrase it is that we're kind of at the stage of marine extinctions are at the stage that terrestrial extinctions were at in the Pleistocene era, I believe. You know, when people first really started hunting and eradicating species. So that in itself is kind of positive. And if you look at, you know, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, where terrestrial extinctions were really accelerated after the Industrial Revolution. So the fear is that, you know, if the ocean is industrialized with, you know, wind power and seabed mining and whatever else, that it could create a surge of extinctions. But for the moment, it's positive.
Given the fact it sounds very positive.
The caveat that the data is deficient in some areas.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's also, you know, ocean acidification and the bleaching and the you know the warming and things and you know, but we don't fully know what all the effects of that could be or will be and how that will play out. But I've also seen some real positive things where they've seen some smaller local ecosystems bounce back, like I was telling you with the crab bank and some other areas. So that's nice to hear.
Well, you know, the other thing is that fish have shown to have an incredible capacity to rebuild. And there've been lots of examples of it. If you leave them alone and stocks will rebuild. And ocean deserts will come back to life. You know, there's what Cabo Pulmo in Panama is one example. It was just kind of nothing happening. And now it's like a tropical underwater jungle. And
I love that. You
know, in 20 years. So that's positive.
I think that's a big difference between ocean conservation, so to say, if we want to use that term, and land conservation. So what we've seen in holistic land management and land conservation, when we quarantine or border off an area and preserve it, and that we need some of that movement and interaction of herds and animals to leave their dung and their manure and to kind of trod down that to get the soil back up to health, that's actually a positive thing. That whereas we quarantine humans and animals and into these preserves, that they actually don't see a huge uptake and increase of land fertility, or that place comes back and thrives. Whereas in the oceans, I think it's a much different beast, that there's not really like, I think that ecosystem still preserved. If we just leave it untouched for a while, it probably bounce back, have the ability to bounce back in some respects.
Well, that's the hope. And that's why, you know, there's all these kind of ideas and initiatives to put X percent of the ocean into conservation, close the fishing. And there's now 8% is kind of in these kind of no take reserve zones, but the hope is to get up to 30% by 2030, but that seems like a stretch. Yeah. But you know, I mean, and some people talk about closing off all the high seas, all the areas outside of, you know, every country's exclusive zone. Daniel Pauly is one of those who would like to close off all the high seas to fishing. And he claims that it wouldn't really change the world catch by that much, because, but it would probably act as a refuge and give fish an opportunity to adapt to climate change, among other things, if they weren't trying to escape hunters and capture. They could put their energy into adaptation.
Yeah, I love that. That's nice. I have three questions left for you. This one's probably the hardest one that I give you. It's kind of tied to the book, but it's not. It's more your personal view. What does a world that works for everyone look like for you?
Well, I mean, that is a tough question. Well, I think, a lot of it comes back to what I was talking about before, is that this connection between producers and consumers. I think that if, there was more of a two-way street between the producer and the consumer, and more of an understanding of one another, that things would be a lot better, and you can see it with some companies like Patagonia and companies like that, where there's, the consumer and the producer are kind of on the same wavelength. And that creates a, better products, it's more sustainable, less destructive. And so I think that would be a starting point.
Love it. Thank you. That's great. So the last three questions or last two questions are really, if there was one message that you could depart to all my listeners as a sustainable takeaway that had the power to change their life, what would it be, your message? And it's okay if it's more than one message, but what's kind of your takeaway when you write these books and in the work that you do, that you want to depart to people as a sustainable takeaway that changed their life?
Well, I think, that is really to try to understand, as you say, systems more. And because I think a lot of people jump to conclusions about things in the world or the state of affairs in the world, without really knowing how things get to where they are and why they are the way they are. It just seems like that people could step back a little bit and really try to think about, the producers, the supply chain, the other half of the equation, that it would kind of illuminate their view of the world. And it's a hard thing to do, right? Because who's in a daily busy life, you're not going to try to understand large complex systems. But you can actually not take everything at face value and jump to conclusions, which I think is what, is human nature, and is more often the case than not.
You think you've been more at an advantage with coming kind of from the innovation side of things in some respects, or at least reporting on that, and also your work from MIT, to kind of get a little bit more of this platforms? I mean, for technology are all run on platforms, which is a very systemic type of a model, a systems type of a model. Do you think that helps you at all?
Well, it probably does. I mean, I guess, because I've done a lot of writing about and thinking about entrepreneurship and technology. And I guess if you think of, the entrepreneurs who are creating great new things are really doing deep thinking about, what is good and what will help the world. And so So maybe some of that has rubbed off. I don't know. But it is a different, people who are trying to create new things from scratch is very exciting, right? And especially if they're trying to create new things from scratch that are, you know, going to have really positive impact on, you know, large numbers of people.
Love that. Yeah, I agree. Most of the pioneers or innovators I've seen are ones who are solving a problem that they're struggling or suffering with as well. They're like, it's not working for me anymore. I need to fix that and create a new system. And they've all been really super, super innovations that have come about that have really started to help billions of people. The last question is, what have you experienced or learned in your professional journey so far that you would have loved to know from the start?
Would have liked to have, you know, this again is kind of gets back to what I was just saying in terms of worldview about, you know, how to think about the world. I would have liked to have been more engaged with the world at large, the international world, from a younger age, because like I have been in the last 20 years, but if, you know, because it definitely gives you a different perspective on issues and a different way of thinking about things. And it forces you to kind of second guess your assumptions about things, because you see them from another person's perspective.
Love that. Nicholas, thank you so much for letting us all inside of your ideas. It's been a sheer pleasure. It's all the hard grilling questions I have for you. The Blue Revolution, what a wonderful book. Like I said, I read it twice. It was really good. It's an eye opener. It's also very hopeful. I'm optimistic because I read it, because I can see all the great things that are emerging and coming out there. And if we just continue that ripple effect, that voice, that they are working, they are positive, there's other and different better systems out there available. It's not all doom and gloom, that maybe we can spread that so that everybody is using those effective systems, that they're learning there are other options and things to do, that new technologies that will really put us on the right side of history when it comes to seafood, our oceans, and the way we do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark, so much. Thank you for reading the book, and I'm glad you liked it. And thanks for having me on your podcast, your video podcast. And I hope we stay in touch.
Thank you. Definitely will. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.